at the end of the month. And then there's other narrations, and like I was literally going to sit down and do the math for this, but I thought, no, I'll let you do the math. But it's quite amazing. So some narrations also say that Allah forgives whoever he pleases on the first night of Ramadan, whoever. Yeah, Allah could forgive one believer. Allah could also forgive every single believer. It's up to Allah. And then, after that first night of Ramadan, Allah will forgive twice the number he pardoned the previous night. And this goes on every single night. So basically, it's a doubling every single day. And then, on the very last night of Ramadan, he will forgive twice the number of people he pardoned during the whole month that had just passed. Huge numbers. So what does this tell us? So Allah is basically inviting us to just do what we can. And obviously just the very fact that we're fasting will be pleasing to Allah and will invite mercy from Allah. But obviously if we can, in a sense, get our act together and really polish away some of those bad traits we have, try to establish good habits, at least get rid of bad habits and maybe even establish some good habits. So by bad habits may be a little one that many of us have, snapping at people. You know, we get a little bit annoyed at someone, all of a sudden we've just said something a little bit harsh, and it can hurt people. So maybe that's something we could work on. Another thing, good thing, just staying in touch even with distant relatives, just sending them a message, calling them every so often. Yeah, anything. Just look at how much mercy is waiting for us. So I pray that everyone is able to benefit from this, reminds themselves of this ocean of mercy that is awaiting all of us in the holy month of Ramadan. And I also look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Arab English Radio. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
In the limelight.
Benjamin Netanyahu's horrific resumption of the war on Gaza shows that no US-backed ceasefire deal is worth the paper it is printed on. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for the first part. Middle East Eye wrote, at 2:20 a.m. on Tuesday local time in the Gaza Strip, Washington inaugurated a new era in world politics. This was the moment Israel timed its attacks on dozens of targets in the enclave to coincide with Suhoor, the pre-dawn meal eaten by Muslims in preparation for a day of fasting. The timing was designed to inflict maximum civilian casualties as families across Gaza gather to eat and pray during the holy month of Ramadan, even if they had little or no food to consume. The mass simultaneous attacks on 100 separate locations achieved their objective, making it one of the worst acts of wanton butchery by Israeli regime forces during the 15-month war on Gaza. More than 400 Palestinians were killed, including more than 170 children, according to Gaza health officials. The Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu sought and got a green light from Washington before launching these attacks. We'll be right back. U.S. President Donald Trump thus signaled a new era in global affairs by giving his consent for a wave of attacks that broke every aspect of the ceasefire deal signed in the presence of international guarantors. In one act, Trump turned the West that his nation claims to lead into the Wild West. From this moment on, no treaty, ceasefire, or international agreement that the U.S. regime signs is worth the paper it is printed on. A U.S. president who persuaded the people of Michigan that he was a man of peace and even the next potential recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize now uses the label Palestinian as a political slur against Jewish Democratic politicians. The president who vowed to stop all wars has launched or permitted airstrikes in Yemen, Gaza, Lebanon, and Syria simultaneously and is promising that all hell will break loose on other countries if they do not submit to his demands. A U.S. president who told the families of the hostages that he would do everything in his power to get them back alive has allowed the Zionist regime to effectively apply its Hannibal directive to the two dozen who, before Tuesday morning's attacks, were believed to be living. If the Zionist regime behaves like this, what incentive does it now give Hamas to keep the remaining hostages alive? For Netanyahu, the timing of these attacks was everything for quite different reasons. On Tuesday, he was due to appear in court on multiple corruption charges, which, as the case progresses, are tightening a noose around his political neck. The renewed war gave him an excuse to tell the court he could not attend. As Ahmad Tibi, a Knesset member and chairman of the Tall Party, writes in the Middle East Eye, it is no coincidence that Tuesday's bombardment comes just before a key budget vote, with ultra-Orthodox lawmakers threatening to topple the government if a law excluding their community from conscription is not passed, and former National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir issuing ultimatums. Bezalel Smotrich, Netanyahu's finance minister and leader of the extremist religious Zionist party, was right all along when he assured the world that Netanyahu would resume the war in Gaza. Recently, Smotrich said the hostage families had been hurt too much during a clash at the Knesset with Ayala Metzger, the daughter-in-law of a slain captive, Yoran Metzger, saying, "We thought that we were serving in the Israeli army and not the army of God's vengeance. In these very moments, we are murdering hostages and there is a deal on the table." But for the religious Zionists, who now form the single most powerful group in Israel, the Army of God's Vengeance is exactly what the Gaza campaign is all about. They have done everything in their power to make a dispute over land into a religious war. For years, they have pushed police to attack worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan, directly prompting the Al-Aqsa Storm Operation, which the group dubbed Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. Hamas is proscribed as a terrorist group in the UK and other countries in the West. Even the bitterest of foes can agree to stop fighting during religious festivals. But the Zionist regime recently did not just renege on a ceasefire deal it had signed. It specifically targeted worshippers gathered to perform a religious ritual. If the Zionist regime is a small settler colonial beachhead in a region entirely surrounded by Muslims, this attempt to turn the conflict into a religious one represents folly of suicidal proportions. The flame it has lit in all Muslim hearts will be hard to extinguish. It will be equally hard, if not impossible, for the survivors of this attack to consider a common future with Israeli Jews in either two states or one state. its actions on October 7, 2023, the resistance movement Hamas remains, in view of most military analysts, a disciplined militia that sticks to the agreements it signs. It is the child killer regime of Israel that is acting like an undisciplined force of terror, violating an internationally recognized deal multiple times. Even before the Zionist regime's recent attack, the Israeli regime had killed more than 150 Palestinians in Gaza during the ceasefire. It failed to start talks regarding Stage 2 on the 16th day of Stage 1, as prescribed in the deal. It failed to fulfill its commitment to withdraw from the Philadelphia Corridor. It delayed the release of Palestinian prisoners for a week. The Zionist regime has behaved like a mafia, attempting to bully Gaza into a different deal altogether. It formulated a proposal, which it put in the mouth of Steve Witkoff, although there was no word of endorsement from Trump's envoy, and demanded that Hamas release 11 living hostages and half of the dead in return for a 50-day ceasefire. This would have been a completely different deal from the one negotiated by Qatari and Egyptian mediators over months.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
Hello and welcome to Unscripted. I'm Kaba Tahwe. Our guest today is Graham Fuller. He is an American author and political analyst, and he specialized in terrorism and extremism, especially in the West Asia region. Now, formerly, he was the vice chair of the National Intelligence Council, and he also served as a station chief in Kabul for the CIA. And he now joins us for this edition of the program. Graham Fuller, welcome to Unscripted.
Thank you, Kaveh. My pleasure.
Yes, our pleasure also. Let's start off with the fact that you specialize in terrorism based on the bio that we have read on you, specifically in West Asia or Middle East, as some call it. And you were also the vice chair of the National Intelligence Council. And you served as the station chief in Kabul for the CIA. Now, given that background, especially the last part, I'd like to find out from you how the CIA... portion of your background, given the fact that it has been involved in regime change operations, how it incorporated itself, in order for us to get an idea if that is something that you're even allowed to speak on.
Well, it's not so much whether I'm allowed to speak about it. I never was involved in that kind of thing personally. I was in the Middle East. I should correct you. I was not a terrorist specialism. I was an analyst and reporting on political developments and political analysis. I had very little to do with terrorism except observing it as a political phenomenon in the region. So I think there is a great deal written about CIA involvement in regime change over the years, but fortunately, did not have to become involved in that, and I'm glad, because I would have probably had a lot of personal problems with becoming involved in it. But yes, major powers have been involved, including the British going back hundreds of years, the U.S. involved in changing regimes that they don't like. It goes on in Europe, elsewhere, so this is nothing new.
Maybe you can tell us then, during the time that you were the station chief in Kabul, it was during that time, based on, again, history, the Soviet Union at that time sent thousands of troops into Afghanistan. and they assumed complete military and political control of Kabul. At that point, then U.S. President Jimmy Carter was authorized for a collaboration between the CIA and Pakistan's inter-services intelligence, the ISI. Now, the reason why I'm bringing this up is because at that point, the U.S. actually was providing funds for the Mujahideen, as it was cited. This is the part that I want to ask you about, is why the U.S. would be involved in doing that, lining itself up either directly or indirectly by this financial support that it gave to the Mujahideen then.
Well, I should think it's obvious. First of all, I should say personally, I served 3 years, and my three-year tour in Afghanistan ended roughly about the time of the Sour Revolution, when the communist, pro-Russian communist movement, Parcham, pulled a coup d'etat and replaced the former ruler. At that point, within the new government was very incompetent. They did not know how to run the country. Rebellions were springing up here, there, and elsewhere from traditional religious sources. And they finally had to invite the Soviet Union to come in and protect the new regime, which the Soviet Union did. In any case, I had left Afghanistan at that point, but I was interested and well aware of these events. I'm surprised that you are surprised that Washington was involved. This was a direct invasion by the Soviet Union into Afghanistan to preserve a communist regime that upset every Muslim regime in the area. Certainly Pakistan, certainly Saudi Arabia, most of the Arab states were strongly disapproved of the Soviet invasion to defend a communist regime, a new communist regime in Afghanistan. So there's nothing surprising to me at all that this is what the Russians did. And it, of course, was spectacularly unsuccessful, just as so many American interventions militarily have been ultimately unsuccessful.
Yeah, it wasn't the fact that I was surprised. The point that I was zooming in on, which is a lead up to the question that I want to ask you now, is the way that the U.S. actually supports groups that it opposes. And my question is going to be now merged with this notion of how, for example, you have talked about the ISIL, which we call Daesh terrorists. What are your thoughts, and what have you said about, maybe I should ask you, about ISIL? Because I have what you have said in an interview. I think the U.S. is one of the key creators of ISIL. Again, we call them Daesh. The U.S. did not plan the formation, but its destructive interventions in the Middle East, West Asia, and the war in Iraq were the basic causes of the birth of ISIS.
Well, at that point, I think the U.S. was still continuously very much focused on anti-Russian policies, and that actually is even true, has been true up to very recently. So at that point, the Washington seemed to be willing to play with the devil and lend some initial support to ISIS or ISIL. It's ISIS is how it's better known in the West. To essentially weaken any effort by left-wing or pro-Soviet forces in the region.
Very well. I'll skew my questions in other ways then. We won't be talking about that CIA regime change stuff. So let's,
I disapprove of CIA regime change. I've all my life, but I have not been involved in it.
No. I didn't mean to to imply that you were involved in it. I was just wondering the inner workings of how that comes about, because it's obviously something that we are have been a victim of.
I know about these mechanisms is reading about it and hearing about it indirectly. We all know the U.S. has supported so-called democratic groups within these countries through the National Democracy Institute in Washington, maybe AID at some point, supporting alternative parties, supporting groups that are unhappy with the existing government and are seeking to overthrow them. There have been a variety of techniques that CIA has been involved in, almost all of them unsuccessful, and fortunate, anyway, enough said on that.
Sure. Well, since we're talking about the region that we're in, which is where I'd like to continue with you, I'd like to talk about Iraq because the anniversary is coming up, the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq. The way that worked out obviously opened a Pandora's box. Tell us, and I'm quoting you here, we must remember that there would be no ISIS today if the U.S. had not invaded and destroyed Iraq's leadership, government, et cetera. These terrorists are a product of that in terms of what we have seen. Again, whether it's ISIS, ISIL, we call them Daesh. Tell us what happened there, why that became one of the consequences.
Well, Saddam Hussein, who was a horrific leader, as we all know, in Iraq, and a butcher, essentially viewed any Islamic opposition, or any opposition for that matter, but especially Islamic opposition, as extremely dangerous. And so he moved ruthlessly to destroy any of these movements that existed. So the United States, I think, rather opportunistically sought to support certain anti-Iraqi regime Islamic forces in the name of defeating Saddam Hussein. And also when Saddam collapsed, the country was absolutely without law and order. The U.S. was not able to maintain law and order, and these jihadi groups took advantage of that opportunity to build their power and to establish themselves in parts of eastern Iraq.
Well, when you talk about the way that the U.S. was involved, either directly, indirectly, or covertly, it is not the first time that has happened. I want to cite an example proves this, which was an AP investigation, and it's regarding the AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, where one of the findings of the investigation was that there was a military coalition led by Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S., and that it actually won decisive victories that drove Al-Qaeda from their strongholds across Yemen, and the coalition actually cut secret deals with Al-Qaeda in the form of financing or in the form of arms. And that's what happened, paying some to leave key cities and towns. Does the U.S. use that as a method to line itself up, again, in one way or another with the terrorists in order to achieve its aims and goals?
Basically, I think in terms of Saudi Arabia, Washington has tried to work on the side of Saudi Arabia, with Saudi Arabia, against Islamist terrorist groups. And the Saudi government would fully agree with that. But I don't have any information, was not directly involved in any of that kind of activity. But yes, the U.S. has been very opportunistic in supporting, there is an expression in English saying, any stick to beat a dog, and so, which means you grab a hold of anything that is useful, a useful tool to beat down your enemy. So, but basically, the United States has been more focused on the war against terrorism than it has been on supporting terrorist groups.
Okay. Well, we still know that the U.S. is involved in one form or another. There was plenty of evidence that came out during the war on Syria that transpired over the 11 or 12 years. There was even reports of how there were these terrorists that were a stone's throw away from the U.S. Base by the name of Al-Tanf. And that was even cited by Russia, of course. But these terrorists were in the area. The U.S. did exterminate some of them, but then we have seen what has happened to Syria. But let's move on more about the violation of Iraq's sovereignty. That war was a devastating one. To this day, we have reports that the U.S. holds Iraq hostage with the dollar basically the revenues go into one account of the U.S. Treasury. I don't know if you're aware of that, but that really is a violation of a country's sovereignty. So is that the way that Iraq is being conducted in terms of its violation of its sovereignty by the U.S.?
Certainly, Iraq has never recovered fully its sovereignty after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein and the installation of a pro-American government there. There have been tensions, as I'm sure you know, between the new anti-Saddam government and Washington. And I don't know any of the details, but I gather that there are some possible U.S. Involvement in oil sources from parts of Iraq. I just don't know anything about that. I have not followed Iraq for a long time and have not been in the area since then. I was in Afghanistan or in Hong Kong. But yes, I think clearly Iraq has not yet fully recovered its sovereignty, and that is a source of considerable anger to the Iraqi population, especially after the destruction of that country during the American attack and invasion.
The U.S. presence in West Asia is something that Iran has obviously been completely against for a variety of reasons, all of which is understandable based on its point of view. I'd like to find out from you what your thoughts are about what we are hearing these days, which is becoming louder and louder, and that's how the U.S. and the Israeli regime are beating the drums of war again. You know, they're talking about attacking Iran's nuclear facilities. They're using the nuclear bomb card again. And, you know, when we look back at how George Bush Jr. had ordered the Pentagon back in 2010 to attack Iran's nuclear facilities, he said that he had directed the Pentagon this would stop the bomb clock at least temporarily. But, you know, here we are, it's 2025. I mean, we're looking at so many years to have gone by. Don't you think that this card of Iran being after the nuclear bomb is overplayed and really expired?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it has been a basic part of U.S. policy in the Middle East, not only in the Middle East, in the world, I would say, to identify enemies and attempt to recruit neighboring countries into alliances with the U.S. That has been the case certainly now in the Persian Gulf, where the boogeyman of Iran in general and Iran's potential nuclear threat has been used to try to drive and bring other Gulf states into close cooperation, military cooperation even, with Washington. Frankly, I don't think this is going to happen. I think it's rather interesting and clear that Trump himself is not a fan of pushing towards ever greater war, and I think everyone knows that it's increasingly clear, especially under Biden, that Benjamin Netanyahu is working to try to drag Washington into a war supporting Israel against both in an attack against the Iranians' nuclear facilities and in a more general war. I think even Biden, who felt that that could be potentially dangerous, but essentially had no control over what Israel did. I think Trump, interestingly, maybe surprisingly, has no desire to go to war, in my understanding, with Iran, and on the contrary, is trying to reopen discussions with Iran on nuclear issues as well as other issues. I don't know how that will go. And typically, as we see, Trump always loves to threaten and bully at the same time while offering more positive incentives to the countries involved. So he's both suggested to Iran that he would like to have negotiations, and then saying, and by God, you will pay a big price if you don't negotiate and don't cooperate on this, and if you continue with the bomb. He's playing both sides against the middle. But my strong feeling is that he does not want to work with Bibi to go into a new war on that, and would not like to have an American war that involves that involves the United States. Also, very strikingly, I was quite surprised just the other day, a U.S. spokesman, I think it was Witkoff, said that, publicly said that the United States is not Israel's puppet.
Okay, well, that's since you're mentioning Israel, we are looking at two attacks that took place in terms of counter attacks from Iran, Operation True Promise 1 and 2. Israel also has attacked Iran. This has been the closest the two have come to an all-out war. And the problem that we have over here is that Israel is nuclear-armed, though it's undeclared. Something needs to be done about denuclearization. And that's something that Iran has voiced its concern. Qatar just came out days ago also voicing its concern. What can be done in order for the disaster not to happen and for Israel to comply in terms of becoming, let's say, a member of the NPT and to completely disarm from nuclear weapons?
Well, I'm afraid I think that's something of a wishful dream at this point. The problem is, as you well know, and as the world knows, that Israel is basically absolutely determined to maintain this nuclear superiority. On top of that, it has great support, I would even say domination in the Middle East and policy over American Congress and seemingly even in Europe to some extent. So I do not think that anybody is going to bring Israel for the foreseeable future, and I'm thinking 5-10 years at the very least. I don't see what it would be that would force Israel to give up its nuclear weapons, however desirable that might be. Congress would never support that, and I don't know what American president would support that either, and I'm not even sure most of European states, who are very weak, there's hardly any serious leadership in Europe right now, I don't think any of them would support it. The only long-term hope I have for a change in the relationship and role of Israel in the region is that Israel has grossly and outrageously overreached itself in its brutal and genocidal attacks against the Palestinian population and has won the disgust and anger of virtually the entire world, except in the U.S. and except in Western Europe. But I think as the Global South, as you might call it, or BRICS states, or the non-Western states grow more and more disgusted with this and trying to put more and more pressure on Israel on questions of genocide and the ICJ, International Court of Justice, and other things, Israel is now very, very isolated. It doesn't affect its brutal policies in Gaza right now, but I believe that Israel is becoming more and more a pariah state, which will find over time it is not going to exercise the same voice or authority or influence as it does right now. Indeed, there are many Jews and many within Israel who are deeply concerned about the gradual moral collapse of the Israeli state.
Well, you know, we need to talk about this a little bit more in terms of what Israel has in mind for the West Asia region or Middle East, as the West calls it, because I can't help but look back at what, I'm sure you're aware of this, what the former American General Wesley Clark has said about how seven countries are going to be toppled in West Asia. This is going back quite some time. The U.S. also believes in partitioning countries. We know that, for example, Condoleezza Rice talked about the new Middle East map, if you recall that, and also how Israel itself has this notion of greater Israel. You know, these all points to taking over countries or cutting countries apart, and this makes it dangerous. We've seen what happened in the Gaza Strip, as you mentioned, and then Lebanon, and perhaps, again, aspirations of Israel. Do you think that Israel is going to go through with this? And the problem here is that the U.S. is backing it. One way or another, we've seen that that is an unshakable bond, as the U.S. has said time and again.
I'm not so sure it's an unshakable bond at this point, and ironically, I never would have predicted it, but I see more independence of action and mind and policy on the part of Trump vis-a-vis Israel than we've ever seen under Biden or preceding American administrations.
Well, let me jump in and ask you, what do you see as proof of that? Because Trump, just 2 weeks ago, released all the backup orders, which included the 2,000-pound bombs, to this Israel.
I agree. This man is very erratic. I don't think anybody is fully able to explain it. But I think there have been many indications that Israel Netanyahu is quite uncomfortable with what essentially is an American takeover of many aspects of Israeli policies. For example, as I think you're aware, Trump said that to solve the Gaza situation, that the U.S. would take over Gaza. He said this in Netanyahu's presence, who obviously looked extremely startled. I mean, Israel wants Gaza, not the U.S. to dominate Gaza. So that's the start. There have been other signs of tensions. He has been sending, I'm surprised, he named several Jewish negotiators, American Jewish negotiators, to go to the Middle East. But many of them have been quite tough with Netanyahu, including forcing him in very blunt and crude language to sign the ceasefire quite immediately. I think you know about this.
Yes.
When Witkoff went there, the ceasefire was about to come to an end. It needed to be re-signed, and Witkoff was assigned to go to get this done within the few days before it ran out. He said, I am coming to Israel on Saturday, and we are going to sign this document. And the Israelis said, oh, I'm sorry, Saturday is Shabbat, our holy day, so we can't do business on Shabbat. And Witkoff, who is an American Jew, is said to have said, I don't give a shit about your Shabbat. I'm coming, and you're signing the document. This Bibi is not used to this kind of language. So, and then coupled with a remark just the other day, as I quoted earlier, that somebody, I think it was Witkoff, said Israel, that the U.S. is not Israel's pawn, or whatever the word was, puppet or pawn. So I think there is greater tension growing between Bibi on the one hand and Trump on the other. But if you ask me about those bombs, what can I say? The best explanation, my personal explanation, is that he's showing, we will support you, and here's a sign that we're supporting you, but by God, we are going to be more in control of what these policies are. And so maybe this is my final farewell gift. I don't know, Kaveh, I don't know. But I'm trying to best interpret this as best I can, and that Trump wants to seize control back from Bibi, which America has never had up to now. He will never succeed in doing that entirely, sure. But I see the signs of this.
Sure. Well, one of the signs was when Trump on social truth platform that he owns posted an interview that Jeffrey Sachs had, political analyst, and we know the views that he expressed in that particular post against Netanyahu. The thing here is that we're looking at the way that, the sounds of war is being echoed through the chambers, whether it's in the White House, whether it's in the Israeli regime's compounds, and maybe other places. For example, what do you make of the deal that the U.S. has now sealed with Saudi Arabia, apparently, which is to the tune of $1 trillion. That involves military sales. Saudi Arabia purchasing military sales, not $1 trillion, but a portion of it. Well, it's got to use it at some point. So what could Trump have said in order for Saudi Arabia to want to purchase that? We know in the past it's been the Iranophobia factor.
Yes, but I think, Kaveh, you surely are aware of one of the most dramatic diplomatic events in the Middle East over the last 2 years was when China intervened to negotiate and mediate between Saudi Arabia and Iran. I think almost all Middle Eastern specialists were startled by that event. Some more ignorant commentators on the Middle East would have said, oh, well, Shiites hate Sunnis, and this is until the end of time. It's a permanent state of affairs. Well, when China came, it was able to negotiate and mediate an agreement that I think is extraordinarily important, and it suggests that Saudi Arabia is no longer finding its major role in the Middle East. I think the Gulf states in general are no longer finding that they want to sign up with the American anti-Iranian agenda. That's not going to work. It's not helping the region. It's pushing it towards war. But yeah, I'm sure Trump is happy to maybe sell some weapons to Saudi Arabia. He's very much hoping at some point that he can bring some deal between Israel and Saudi Arabia, a peace treaty. I don't know what Trump thinks about all of this. It's wide open. But that's the best explanation that I can give to it. But I truly believe that Saudi Arabia is serious about putting an end to this conflict with Iran. It's pointless, it has very little ground, and it's been mainly engineered and supported by Washington over the years in the search for regional enemies.
All right, very well. Thank you so much. Let me thank you, Graham Fuller, American author and political analyst. Thank you so much for joining us in this edition of Unscripted.
My pleasure, Kaveh. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, that was Graham Fuller. As I mentioned, American author and political analyst. We had the pleasure of having him, and we talked at length, no surprise, about West Asia. Until the next Unscripted, for me, Kaveh Takwe, it's goodbye.
بسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
قد دعوتك ربي بقرآني جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسان ودعوتك ربي بقرآني.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May the peace and blessings of Allah be upon the soul of Prophet Muhammad and his purified progeny. Dear audience, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program Let's Recite the Quran, coming to you from the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm your host Mahdi, and as always, we are joined by Quran expert, dear brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam, brother Mahdi, and assalamu alaikum to all of the dear listeners of this program, and thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, brother. Well, dear audience, as you may know, this program, Let's Recite the Quran, consists of several Quranic parts. First, we are going to talk about a famous Quran reciter. Then, we are going to listen to a recitation by that reciter. After it, Brother Muhammad will analyze that recitation. So please stay tuned. Well, today we are going to listen to a recitation by Sheikh Mustafa Ismail. This prominent Egyptian reciter was born in 1905 and passed away in 1978 at the age of 73. He is entitled Malikul Qurra, which means the king of reciters. He had a unique voice. He recited the Quran in a particular fashion, employing the Arabic maqamat to illustrate the words of Allah to the listener. He moved easily between maqamat and never went off tone. Many famous reciters were influenced by the style of this prominent reciter, such as Sheikh Ahmad Nu'ayna, Sheikh Raghib Mustafa Ghalwash, and Sheikh Hamdi Zamil. Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is interested in his recitations and has invited Quran reciters to follow his style. Now let's listen to the recitation of Surah Al-Qasas, verses 23 and 24, recited by Sheikh Mustafa Ismail. Let's enjoy it.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ولما ورد ما فسقيلهما ثم تولي إلى الظل فقال رب إني لما أنزلت إلي صدق الله العظيم
كتاب
Dear audience, you're still listening to the program Let's Recite the Quran, coming to you from the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And what you just listened to was recitation of verses 23 and 24 of Surah Al-Qasas, recited by Sheikh Mustafa Ismail. And now, Brother Muhammad, let's talk about this beautiful recitation.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Okay, Sheikh Mustafa Ismail is reciting the method of recitation of Hamza, the qira'ah of Hamza. It could be, I'm not sure if it's khalaf or khalad. It could be either one. But for the most part, Egyptian reciters use riwayah of khalaf on Hamza. And there are certain signs. The most obvious one is the sect. For example, ma amadiyana. Sect means making a pause and then continuing without taking a breath.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is sect. And we have it whenever, especially whenever there is a saken letter followed by a hamza. Okay, for example, al-ard would be pronounced like this. Al-ard. Of course, in continuation, not on stopping on the word. If you stop on the word, you should do just like tasheel, min al-lar, qulli al-amr, or for example, in Surah Al-Nazi'at, mata'al lakum ولينعامكم. حمزة reads ولينعامكم with تسهيل at the end. If you stop on the word,
yes.
Okay, تسهيل takes place. Otherwise, you have to do sect. So this was one sign, sect. Another sign, which is rather strange, is the word yuz. The sod is pronounced like a zay with tafkhim. Okay, this takes place whenever the sod is sakin or whenever it has a kasra. Okay, for example, in Surah Al-Hamd, Hamza reads it. Actually, I'm not sure if Khalaf at least reads it like this. This is Khalaf and Hamza.
It's somehow odd.
That's just like I said, it's really strange. Yuzdirarriya. Actually, it makes it easier when you pronounce, because Siratalladina is a lot more difficult than saying Siratalladina.
But the word has changed, actually.
Okay, it's something in between a sod and a zay. It's not exactly a pure zay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about common points of tajweed, if you agree.
Let's just mention a few more differences and then we'll go to the common points. We have imala a lot in Hamza. Fasaqi, tawalli ila al-dhil. These are imala. Imala means that it's 50% fatha and 50% kasra.
While in Hafs an Asim, it's pronounced like an aliful mad.
A normal aliful mad, just like the fatha doubled. But in imala, it's halfway between an aliful mad and ya'ul mad. Okay, now let's talk about some of the other rules of tajweed are the same. We also had another difference. We had min dunihumum ra'atayn. In Hafs, it's dunihimum ra'atayn. But in Hamza, the ha has a dhamma. So it's duni humum ra'atayn in Hamza, just like the way Sheikh Mustafa Ismail recited these verses. We have tafkhim of ra in the phrase duni humum ra'atayn. Of course, I'm reciting in Hamza. I just recited this phrase in Hamza, just like Mustafa Ismail.
And you're talking about common rules now.
Yes, the common rules. Im ra'atayn. The ra has tafkhim. It means you have to read it with velarization. The ra should be velarized. And velarization means the back of the tongue is raised toward the velum.
But practically, we can say we pronounce it with the full mouth.
Yes. Ra. Ra.
Ra.
There's no pharyngealization. We only have velarization. Yes. We don't say ra. Ra. That would be too much tafkhim.
Yeah, that's difficult.
That's only for the letters of istirla. Okay, another rule which is shared among almost all the riwayat is qalqala, khatubukuma. In most qira'at, we have sukun on the ta. Sometimes in certain riwayat, instead of a sukun, there is another haraka. Okay? For example, a letter that has a haraka becomes sakin. As an example, in qalun, wahuwa is always wahwa. The ha gets a sukun.
Wahwa.
Wahwa al-aziz wal-hakim, for example. But in the other riwayas, it's not like that. And we have matul munfasil in the phrase tawalli ila. This is matul munfasil. In Hamza, you have to lengthen it to 6 vowel counts. But in Hafs, you have 3 choices.
Yes.
2, 4, or 5 vowel counts.
Of course, the first time you come across it.
The first time, yes. That's right. And the first time is in this phrase. In the recitation that we listened to Mustafa Ismail, the first time that you come across matul munfasil is in this phrase. And so in Hamza, you have to lengthen it to 6 vowel counts, and you have the option to apply sect or not. Okay? Reciters such as Mustafa Ismail, Minshawi, Hassan. These reciters, they usually do sect on the long vowels, both Madul Muttasil and Munfasil. But other reciters, such as Abdul Basit, such as Kamil Yusuf, and if I'm not mistaken, Muhammad Al-Laythi, they don't apply the sect on the long vowels.
You mean after the long vowels?
Yes, after the long vowels. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you, Brother Muhammad, and thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. That was the final part of the program, Let's Recite the Quran. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And don't forget to visit our website, that is parstoday.com. Please click on the tab Call of Islam, and there you can listen to this program as well as other programs of this radio. Until next time, we'll leave you in Allah's care. Have a nice time and goodbye.
صفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن وفيه محاسن الأخلاق هو القرآن.
IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
More than 3,000 vessels of the Iranian Navy and besieged volunteer forces have held a massive parade in support of the people of Palestine. Over 24 Palestinians have been killed in the latest Israeli attacks on Gaza, as the death toll since renewed attacks on March 18th reaches 855. And Yemen says it's carried out more anti-Israel and anti-U.S. operations in retaliation for their aggression against the Gaza Strip and the Arab country itself. Hello everyone and a very warm welcome to World News. Our top story, across Iran's territorial waters, a powerful display of maritime solidarity has unfolded. One day prior to International Quds Day, The IRGC's Navy and Basij volunteer forces staged a massive parade, sending a clear message of support to the people of Palestine and condemning